Good morning, everybody. You're listening to the Mighty 690K GGF. Kyle High in studio with you. And as always on Wednesday around this time, we have Greenside up and we have the gentleman in from the Kansas State Extension Office. We have a Jacob Weber and James Coover. Gentlemen, how are you doing this morning?
Good morning.
Pretty good. Doing good.
So we're 2 weeks from Christmas. So before we get started, I assume everybody's ready for Christmas, or have you got your shopping done yet? Because I definitely have not.
I haven't even started. I haven't done nothing.
Let's be honest, I haven't started either. So
I'll personally be ready for Christmas on the 26th.
Yes, because we'll talk about that near the end of the show, but James is going to be retiring, so you got this show, and then I think one more show left after this, correct?
Did you mean me?
Not James, Jacob.
Yeah,
Jacob.
Yeah, I'm retiring.
That'd be an early retirement for you, James, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah, he probably this store there looking, really?
I meant Jacob.
Okay.
But this is basically your next to last show, isn't it?
Yep, started the first show, as much as I can determine from my records, was May 2nd, 1990.
Wow.
First show on KGGF. And that was, I did it with Jim Fisher. He gave me a call and he said, come on down. Okay. I found the station. He said, sit in this room over here. This what right here.
It wasn't this one we were in. It was the studio next door.
And he was in the other studio. He said, okay, we're going to be on the air. Don't worry. There's only about 15,000 people listening. All right.
Woo.
Yes. And, of course, I was a new agent and hadn't developed real strong attitudes and opinions, but since then, I have a little bit. Used to carry a lot of books in with me and thought, I'm going to look up stuff real quick while I'm on the air. And, you know, that never worked out. There was never an opportunity. Finally, I just got to wise up and said, just forget it. I'll just shoot from the hip. Mm. And it worked out pretty good.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's been a joy to hear you every week. But again, this is your next last show. Your next one will be next week. And I think I can say by all the listeners that have been listening, I've got to know you the past just 3 months. We definitely will miss you after your last show next week.
Thank you.
But let's go ahead and get started with our show today. And today you wanted to talk about how plants get their scientific names, basically.
Well, I figured, why don't we just do something just different?
Yeah, off the wall.
Because we talked about poinsettias. We talked about taking care of Christmas trees and Christmas and safety, fire safety. So, okay, scientific names. Scientific names are applied to plants and also animal species and bacteria. I'm going to basically be talking about the scientific naming of plants. Years ago, plants were given a phrase name, and that was all in Latin, and it could be anywhere from, 5 to 25 words long. And very difficult. I don't have a phrase name right now, but it was very cumbersome. And every once in a while, one of the people who worked with botanical names, they kind of tried something different. Carl Linnaeus. Or Carlos Linnaeus, Carl von Linné, in the 18th century, published a book, 1753, I believe that was the year, called Species Plantarum. And in that book, that was Species of the Plants. And back then, they assumed that they knew all the species of plants, about 7,000. They were way off, way, 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 way off. We still don't have them all named. He gave each in the side of the page, he just kind of just gave them a little bit of a notation. He gave them the genus that the particular plant was, and they just put a little epithet on the end of it. And it was a two-word name. And with the publishing of that book, that gave the idea of binomial nomenclature, a two-name or a two-word species name. And it kind of stuck. Now, he had a different type of classification system based on the number of stamens in the flower And of course, that put some weird combinations together, some pine species with some other flowers and flowering plants, but it didn't. It kind of didn't set very well with a good classification system. Since then, classification has changed, and then we went into classification where you had the kingdom, the subkingdom, the domain, the groups, the various groups, class, or order, family, and then genus, and then the subgroup, or out of the genus, called a species. And so the classification systems have changed over the years to try to put a little bit order into how all the species are related to each other and different levels of relationships. And now they have a system now called clades, which is more careful or closely related to groups and the groups that they're in. And at one level of a clade to another, it kind of steps on down to closer relationships. The closest relationships are generally in the families, and then from the step down from the families is the genus, and that gives a little bit of separation among the members of that group, and then it get down to the what's called a species, and then the species is it's a binomial. It's it has to be a combination of two words. One of my pet peeves is the mistake that's given. Folks say, what's the genus Acer? What's the species Palmatum or something like that? And that's not correct. The species names is always a binomial. So Acer Palmatum is the species name. The genus is Acer, and the species is Acer palmatum. The palmatum is called a specific epithet. And for example, you can be confused if somebody says, what's the genus and what's the species? Okay, the species, a person might say Americana. All right, what is Americana? Could it be a Bufo Americana or Chionanthus Americana? They're two different species. Bufa americana is American toad, and Chionanthus americana is the New Jersey tea. Both of them are very common in our area. So that's my pet peeve. The species is a binomial. Okay, remember that.
I remember those from biology, and I just remember going, I was confused half the time looking at it. I was like, I'm not sure what all this means, the genus, and I just remember those from biology and just being slightly confused. I had to have extra tutoring for my science teacher for that.
So if you want to name a plant, you're going to have to be pretty smart cookie and biosystematics or the naming of plants, species. The plant, first of all, I see this particular plant, and it has some characteristics that are different from the other plants that were in that particular group. And so you have to look and say, okay, does this form a population? Is the population genetically or specifically different than the rest of the populations? Okay, yeah, I found one. Good. Okay, I'm going to name it. You can give it a name, but it doesn't count. You have to determine that it is a unique species, and then you have to document it. You have to select a particular plant within that group and press it and dry it, and that will become your holotype. That is the designation that particular dried specimen, you put it in a herbarium, and so this is holotype. But the other thing is you have to publish this information in a scientific journal like Lexon or Taxon. It's okay, all right, you published it and everything goes fine. All right, they name the plant, but then some other fellow says, wait a minute, That particular plant has been named already. Sorry about that.
Oh.
It's called priority. Priority. So they find that, yeah, that's right. Oh, son of a gun.
Got to go back to work.
Yeah, go back to work again. But sometimes some scientists will find a specimen in a herbarium and say, wait a minute, that's been named incorrectly. That really is not the true name of that plant. So they correct it. And so then they become the person who names that plant, but they still have to give credit to the previous person that had named it. But yeah, it's pretty complicated. So if you want to really get out and name a particular plant, you're going to have to be
through a lot of channels,
yeah,
and
yeah,
do a lot of studying.
Often. But then the main thing is that worldwide, a species has a unique name. It's going to be a unique name. It's going to be Latinized. It's going to have to be published in the scientific journal. It's also going to have to have some specimen that designates that particular species. Now, it could be a specimen that exists or description, because there's specimens that may be several hundred years old now that have deteriorated or were destroyed. So there's other specimens that like the syntypes, they are designated as syntypes, but they're in different herbariums, so that you have something at least designates that particular species. It's kind of complicated, but it works. And over a period of time, we come up with all this scientific names, but it eliminates confusion. There's common names, but there's many common names for several plants. I'm trying to think of one. The pin oak is also called a different name, I believe water oak or something like that. But common names vary from region to region, but the scientific name is worldwide. It has the same name worldwide. And it's controlled by the International Code of Botanical Nomenclature, and those folks that are in this group meet about once every 6 years and review all the codes and then try to correct mistakes and things like that. So it's continually refined. So
I know I couldn't name a plant because I'd just be confused. I'd be like, yeah, help, somebody help here.
Yeah.
So that's what I would be doing. Well, James, first of all, I hope you have a very Merry Christmas coming up. You got a few things coming up. In fact, I was talking to you about it before the show. You got something coming up, I think, on the 17th at ICC West.
Yes. So just next week on Tuesday, we're going to have the 2019 Agronomy Night. Agronomy Night, it's been going on for a long time, even before the district was formed. Montgomery County has been having a Agronomy Night for a long time. On December 17th, ICC West Community Building. We'll start around 5:45 registration. We'll probably get done around 8. But we're going to have Dr. Mike Stamm, who is the K-State canola breeder, coming in. And we don't grow a whole lot of canola around here. We don't hardly grow any, but it's that beautiful field of yellow in the springtime. So we're going to have him come in. There's a lot of reasons to think that canola would grow pretty well around here. So I'd like to see more of it. Especially as we get less and less wheat. Besides that, I'm actually going to be presenting a little piece, a much shorter presentation, just a little bit about basically soil fertility within the Montgomery and the surrounding area. And so that, of course, it's a free dinner as well.
Hey,
I mean,
can't beat that.
Yeah, we got lots of sponsors. This is kind of one of my bigger events, and I really hope a lot of the producers in the area come out to this, because this is one of the big ones. So besides that, we have on January the 8th, we have the 2020 Corn School. Basically, the Kansas Corn Commission, they bring in their people. Of course, the speakers will all be K-State Extension people.
Right.
But they kind of set that up, and we're just kind of there supporting. But that will be at the Southeast Research Center on January the 8th. After that, we have, I'm sure Wendy has talked about this a number of times, but the financial skills for the women in ag, I'm sure she has mentioned
it. Yes, she has.
It's intense, big program. We'll have three locations around the Wildcat District. We'll start on January the 15th, and then every Wednesday evening after that. Please let us know soon. We need to get people signed up and ready for this. I'll be at the Hepler Center doing that one as well. But we also have one in Sycamore and Parsons. We also have a lambing and kitting workshop. That'll be on February the 10th. And so if you're interested in goats and sheep and all that, that'll be on February the 10th at 6 p.m. at the Southeast Center as well.
All right. Well, we'll have more stuff to talk about after the break as we're getting up on the hard break here at the top of the hour. So James and Jacob will be back after our news break here at the top of the hour. You are listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF. Good morning, everybody. Help if I turn my mic on. Good morning, everybody. We are back here with Green Side Up with Jacob Weber and James Coover from the K-State Extension Office. And we are going to start with James on this segment. And James, you wanted to talk about soil testing.
Yes. And so it seems odd, but it's getting kind of cold. However, still, we can still do some soil testing. And so now that everything has been harvested, the fields are clean, maybe hopefully they're getting a little bit dry too, so we can actually get out there. There's two different soil tests that we can take right now, and we take them in the same way actually, but they're completely different. One I want to talk about is soybean cyst nematodes. Basically what they are they're tiny little worm parasites that live in the soil. They feed on the soybeans. Pretty much their entire life cycle is dependent upon soybeans. They kind of infest the roots, they lay their eggs on them, and what they'll do is eventually, when they get older, they'll start to tear at the roots, and then they'll lay their cyst on their eggs. And what that can allow diseases to come into the soybean. There's something associated with sudden death syndrome, which is a disease of soybeans that basically kills the entire crop. So they're really a very serious agronomic pest.
Sounds like, yeah, a little nasty things.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, you know, they're tiny little microscopic things too. You can't even see them. These little guys, they need to be controlled one way or the other. But first, you have to determine if they're there. And that's the difficult part, because really the first indication is there's an odd drop in yield that you can't really explain by any other explanation. Usually soybean cyst nematodes will actually be on the entryway of fields, and they'll also be in the flooded areas of the fields. And the reason for that in the entryways is because they're being carried there by agricultural equipment. I mean, these little guys, they don't have wings or anything like
right.
that. Yeah. So they grab onto the tires on the mud, and then when the combine gets transported to the other field, that's when they get left at the entryway. The other way is, of course, by flooding. You know, the water comes up, it carries the nematodes, they end up in another field. So the way to test for these things is you want to take a soil test just like you do a nutrient soil test. You'll use a soil probe, probably around 15 to 20 cores, but with this one, a soybean cyst nematode test, you want to go along the soybean row. And so with a regular nutrient soil test, you kind of want to go disperse within the road, out of the road. You don't want to stick to one particular thing. But that, you just want to go along the roots. The depth isn't as important as the other test, 6-8 inches, somewhere around there. Soybean cyst nematodes, they don't move around very much like the other nematodes. So they'll be there when you take that test. One thing you do make sure is take the test before the ground freezes. Right now, you know, we're getting close to that time period. So once the ground freezes, A, you can't take a soil test, but also it messes with the populations. Once you take that test, it is a biological sample. So don't leave it in your truck. I mean, don't leave it on the counter for a couple of days. You know, you got to keep those little things alive before you can test them. You can probably put it in the refrigerator for a day, or, you know, but try to get into the mail. Usually Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, so that it's not sitting in the truck, the mail truck, over the weekend either. But once they get it, they'll determine the population. And once they do that, they'll give you some options about what to do. If it's a low population, you could probably still plant soybeans. You just need to rotate variety. If it's a higher population, then you have to think about maybe not planting soybeans, rotating out, going to something else. They're actually doing some research that they're looking at cover crops of mustard. It seems odd, but like literally the mustard that you put on your hot dogs.
Wow.
I mean, that plant, when it breaks down in the soil, so you grow it, you know, after the soybeans, you cover crop it, and then you plow it in before you plant soybeans. Well, as it breaks down, it releases a chemical. Do you know what that chemical is?
Chlorpicrin.
Oh, there you go. I knew he would know. Yep. and so basically that chemical breaks down and actually kills the nematodes. And so it's sort of a cool biological control that we're
Never even thought of that. You know, that's pretty interesting though.
Yeah. And so, I mean, there's not a whole lot of things that we can do with that area. So it's kind of cool that there's one that works. And of course, while you're testing for soybeans as nematodes, you can also take some soil tests too. I mean, you're already out there with a soil probe,
right?
So you might as well.
Do a soil test.
Yeah, get your nutrients ready. And that's kind of the same way. 10, 15 cores. That one you want to make sure you're only getting 6 inches of the core. But you probably want to do, 20, 40 acre max per soil test nutrient. With a soybean cyst nematode, you're probably looking at around about a 5 acre area, because usually they're not as spread out.
Right.
So for that, you know, if you're already out there with the soil probe, take some nutrient tests. That way you can get yourself ready for the spring when you're planting your soybeans in.
Do these little guys, do they just feed only on soybeans, or is...
Yes, pretty much. And so I would assume that they will feed other things, but close in their family. But we don't plant anything else but soybeans.
Right.
I mean, you know, we don't plant mung beans or anything.
Right.
So really, really the only thing we're worried about is soybeans. They're not going to get on corn or wheat or sorghum or anything else.
Okay. I was just kind of making sure, because you were saying maybe if it's really bad, don't plant there. Or as you said, plant the cover crop, you know, that they use for mustard. So that's what I was thinking about. I didn't know if it like fed on other things being planted there or not.
But they do. I mean, if you have soybeans and then you plant corn and then go back to soybeans, they can survive. Enough can survive to reinfest every other year. And so, you know, sometimes that rotation has to have a whole extra one. It reduces the population. But the more things you have in your rotation, the harder it is going to be on the parasitic organisms.
Right, because they're used to just the one thing, and if you're rotating stuff, they're just like, they start dying off because they don't have that thing, that certain thing that they need to feed on to keep themselves alive or be able to plant their eggs on the roots, which, like you said, it kind of kills it pretty quick, kind of kills that crop pretty quickly, does it not?
Yes, and so if it's just the nematode, actually, sometimes you don't see them all. You won't even see a difference in the plant because they're tearing up at the roots. You'll have a reduced yield, but it's hard to see until you see it on the yield monitor. It's only when they carry that sudden death syndrome is when it completely kills that plant. And sometimes, you know, it's soybean cyst nematodes are the one that are... It's very elusive. They're hard to determine if they're there or not.
Because like you say, you can't see it with the naked eye, you know?
Exactly. They're all below ground. So the only way to really do this is with a test. And, you know, and if a producer out there does take that test and they have a response or they have a population, please let me know. I would like to know basically what the populations are around my district. And so that way I can kind of... Because see if it's really much of a problem here. So
right. And if they do want to contact you, how can they contact you?
They can call me at the Girard office, really any of the local extension offices. The number for Girard is 620-724-8233, or they can email me as well.
Okay. So again, sometimes you don't even think about these little things, just these nasty little things, because again, like you said, since you can't see with the naked eye, you just think, that's not there, and then all of a sudden you got a lower yield on your soybeans. You're like, what? It looks fine, but you end up with not as great of a yield. Jacob, wanted to come back to you real quick. We were talking, said you wanted to kind of expand a little bit, maybe on the soil test, but also on what you were talking about earlier as
okay,
well.
Okay, scientific naming of plants.
Yes.
We're talking about species, and James and I were talking off the air about it. And one of the things is in the scientific community, how do you designate a species? That's kind of, that gets to be really complicated. So there's various descriptions of what a species is, and several scientists have tried to kind of categorize what really establishes a species. And one scientist said, well, it's a population of plants that share common characteristics and that are exclusively interbreeding. In other words, they cross within themselves, but not with another species. For example, different species of really closely related genus, they may bloom at one point in time, and the other species blooms 2 or 3 weeks later. So though they could have no potential for crossing or interbreeding, so those would be classified as different species, although they share very common, very close relationships as far as leaf characteristics, growth habit, and things like that. However, that was way too simple because there are populations of plants that never breed. They reproduce asexually, and they've done that for thousands of years. And so that throws that particular definition out because now they don't breed.
Right.
So it becomes extremely difficult. And then you can have plants within a group or a population and another population within a geographic region. They may be a little bit separate. And they have a little bit different characteristics as far as maybe leaf shape or some other characteristics, maybe some hairs on the stem. But they interbreed with each other very readily. And so do you designate it as the same? Are the plants the same species or are they different? And so there may be a significant difference that one group, maybe they interbreed, but they're not adapted to the same region. So they may be designated as a subspecies, which there are quite a number of designations of subspecies, which means that they're still the same species, but they're a little different. They have different characteristics. So it becomes very complicated as to what really defines the species. So there's sometimes these high-powered scientists or thinkers and guys, they start, some of them say, we got too many species, we need to lump them together. They're called the lumpers. And then we got the other group that say we want to divide them up. They're dividing the species. They split them out, splitters. They want to get everything really well defined. The trouble is it becomes really difficult to really well define something because plants are genetically diverse, and within one population, you can have plants that kind of look different, and they have a little bit different characteristics, but that variation occurs. So there's always variation. So they really have to really take a step back and say, we can't split them out because even though there's a little bit different characteristics, they're still the same species. So there's always room for arguments. And that's the nature of science, is there's a lot of room for arguing.
That's how it usually is, a lot of arguments in yeah. science, because science is interesting. It's never ends. It's always just a ever-evolving thing, is it not?
That's correct. So there are things that you can say really exist, like heat and cold and things like that are well defined. And then you get things that, okay, we think this is how it operates or how it works, so we're going to create a model. It's a model called a theory. It's a model of how things work. And you hear on the news about models for weather, and they have the European model, American model. Those are theories.
Right.
They're based on hypothesis. You look at natural phenomena, and then you make a hypothesis. I think this is how it works, and then you test it. And you keep redefining it until you get a model that says that pretty much can predict, has a high degree of predictability as to this will happen if this occurs. And so you now have a theory. It's based on hypothesis.
I remember doing that in middle school with the scientific theory, where we had a theory and then we had to create a hypothesis, and then we had to do tests, and we did, I can't remember everything after, but there was a lot of things like, this happened on this test, this happened on this test, and then we would have basically a conclusion, this doesn't work, or this does work, or this does have a chance to work. So I remember that in middle school, and I was just, to me, it was always fun. I don't know why, but it was always fun to me just doing all those tests over and over and seeing maybe if it was all the same, and maybe our hypothesis was right on certain things.
Yeah, so, and then this is all interesting stuff, but what does that have to do with planting a seed of corn out in your garden and get it to grow and produce a crop? Doesn't have much. It's just interesting stuff. If a person wants to get really into it, it's very important stuff. In the scientific world, it's very important to be able to classify and designate species and group them, because it gives us some predictability in our world and ability to not necessarily control our environment, but understand our environment and be able to work with it in a predictable way.
Yeah, because that way you can, like you said, work with it predictably. But, I mean, the world is so large. There's so many things I think we have not even discovered yet.
There's a lot of stuff yet to be discovered. And there never will be a point where we have everything explained. It never will happen.
Never will happen. And that's what makes the world pretty interesting, is that we're always finding new things pretty much almost every day nowadays. So.
It's tremendous. It's a miracle that exists. It is a miracle.
Absolutely.
It happens because of our Creator.
Absolutely. It's a great thing, and to find new stuff every day. So, gentlemen, I thank you very much for coming in today, talking about all this very cool stuff. Again, James and Jacob. And Jacob, we will see you again next week. And okay. James, when are you back next time?
I don't know.
It'll be
after the holidays.
Okay, it'll be after the holidays.
Yeah,
so the only reason I was asking is I just want to wish you a Merry Christmas, because since we will not see you again until after the holiday. All right, we're going to go ahead and take a break. When we come back, we will start Open Line. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF.